The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Good afternoon, it's The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasodhi. No matter how much Malaysia makes in terms of GDP or GNP, what truly affects the average Malaysian is how pieces of the pie is distributed. How does Malaysia distribute its wealth? Dato' Dr. Denison Jayasuriya of UKM's Institute of Ethnic Studies, he was also the former Human Rights Commissioner with Suhakam. He joins me to find out the differing principles and motivations behind wealth distribution and whether we're doing it right in Malaysia. How are you today, Dr. Denison?
I'm fine.
Dr. Denison, before we even go on, the policy of Malaysia on poverty reduction first took place, it was very clear, it was very coordinated in 1971 with the introduction of the NEP. And since then, its basic features have been retained, even though modifications have been made to that policy. Now, in your opinion, how far have we come since 1971?
Okay, I think if we reflect back on the critical data of poverty from 1957 to 70 and post, we would see that there has been a tremendous development policy, strategic policy that has addressed household poverty in a very significant way, reducing income poverty to less than 5% of the household, which was more than 50% at the time of independence. Mm-hmm. So overall, we are looking at, if we use the definition of a basket of goods in terms of income and the ability of a family to buy food, clothing, transport, basic housing, then we have come a long way from poverty in the way globally is defined in terms of $1 or $2 a day. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to acknowledge that in terms of the broader policy framework, Malaysia has been extremely successful. But on the other hand, if we look, then we have issues with regards to income inequality and overall improvement of quality of life. And this has been clearly established in a sense of the sections that are in the bottom 40% of the socioeconomic ladder.
Right. What is the definition? An important prerequisite, of course, is the component of fight against poverty. It is the agreement on the definition and measurement of poverty. So what are we using? Is that really representative?
Okay. This has been disputed by economists, sociologists and others. And, of course, people working on the grassroots, like civil society, have not agreed with what is the basket of goods. How much below what percentage of household income or income, like is 500 ringgit the benchmark or 3,000 ringgit the benchmark for city and so forth. They have used household purchasing prices or from survey to determine what is the basic amount of goods one would need to have a balanced meal, simple housing, clothing and things like that. This is using a basket of goods which is in comparison with the poorest countries of the world. Mm-hmm. It's not using how the developed countries would assess poverty.
Right. So
they would then take average income and divide it by half and then look at average income and then you would see sizable number of people. So in the States, in Canada, in England, you have sizable number of people who are poor, but they are not in abject poverty or in starvation. So it is inequalities and differences between the haves and the have-nots that become an issue.
Right. So should we be comparing with places like Canada and America, or should we be comparing against countries that are worse off than us?
I think Malaysia should change its poverty line measurement. It's a political issue, but to compare it with the richest countries of the world, if we benchmark it with the way poverty is measured in the UK or developed economies, then on one hand we say we are a first world, but when we measure poverty, we are looking at comparing ourselves with the poorest countries. And that is why development policy has introduced another term, bottom 40% or low income. That means we are saying they are not people living on the streets, they are not in abject poverty or starvation, because we look at poverty, then we think of the scenes in Africa or, you know, kids running around, you know, in malnutrition.
That is famine.
That's that sort of picture. Yes. But then if we look at, if we use a quality of life index, what life or quality of life in a range of things, for example, income, housing, health, transportation, even culture, education, if we look at a range of things, how much do people have access to? Then we will compare ourselves to, are more people now in a middle class living environment compared to cost of living, and what is their purchasing power? So you could be in a city like Kuala Lumpur, but live on the poor side of the city. You might, for example, be living near Subang, but you have no capacity to access Subang Medical Center or Sunway Medical Center because they are all private sector driven. Then you have to come to HUKL, which is in Charas, or go to PJ University Hospital. Then you're looking at public facilities. Then in that context, you will see the complexities of cost, transportation, these sort of things that impact day-to-day living. And what can they buy with ₱1,000? Because with ₱1,000, you are not regarded as hardcore poor. Mm-hmm. You are still low income. So the benchmark, should it be 3,000, 4,000, 1,500? So if you take people working in low-paying jobs, and now with a lot of foreign workers around, basic salaries are depressed because migrant workers will work from Bangladesh or Cambodia or India or Indonesia, but locals will not work for ₱800 plus room and board, these kind of things. So this becomes a more complex situation for Malaysia, and the inequality measurement and access to good quality of life becomes a key indicator.
Right. What is our poverty rate at the moment?
In terms of figures, I think we would be, you know, that's where if we are using this benchmark of basket of goods, then we are talking of there's no real poverty in Malaysia.
Oh, really?
In a sense. If
right.
you use that.
Sure.
But if you use a benchmark of low income, people who can afford health care, if we are using a quality of life index, then we will see that in comparison to, it's relative poverty again, in comparison to people in middle or upper middle class, what is their quality of life?
Mm-hmm.
Then we would say there is a great disparity among ethnic communities, and what researchers are showing that within ethnic groups, the disparities would be far greater.
Right.
And that becomes a point of contestation politically and socially because of ethnicity and access to resources, contracts. Are you with a big multinational company or public listed company, or are you with a GLC? And salaries differ based on that.
On your own, Dr. Dennison, at the Institute of Ethnic Studies, have you carried out your own study or survey on poverty rates in Malaysia?
What we have looked at is on the ground, if we look at the bottom 40%. So we have done initially in my earlier work as well, we worked with squatter communities who have now shifted into flats. So they are in 17-story flats or walk-up flats or, you know, rental flats, or they have purchased it. Then when we look at access to services and resources, they're all living in high-rise flats, high density, with very little public facilities. And for employment, they have to go out. The quality of life in terms of public amenities and facilities around their flats, including quality of life, children's performance in school, crime rate, drug, alcoholism, gang-related problems, early dropout from school. Then there is a total manifestation that is much broader of issues for the bottom 40%. So inequality, access to resources, and other indications will show that sections of our community are worse off by coming to some parts of the city as opposed to if they lived in the rural. Because in the rural, healthcare facilities now, schooling, even housing seems to be slightly better.
Mm-hmm.
So how then do we address these inequalities? Then we have to take macro planning and take the other issues of minimum wage, public transportation. These are some things that under the KPIs and NKRAs of the federal government, they're looking at it. But we need to look at disaggregated data. So if you take a Malay community, an Indian community, and a Chinese community living in their flats, their access to public services and resources will differ. Their conflict among them could also differ based on their perception of whether government is friendly to them, whether they can access it. But they're all in the same boat of struggling to make a life. So that's then compared to people with golf courses, private clubs, and better housing, gated communities. So we are living in separate worlds in the city. So while we talk of and so the affluent now, you have a sizable Bumiputra community and non-Bumiputra communities as well. So we can look at some of the root factors, which I would link it to development planning.
Mm-hmm.
What is our view of development, and where would we lay our resources and emphasis? And if it is for equitable distribution, then we will say, who are the people at the bottom, the most vulnerable? Women, children, urban flat dwellers, and things of this sort. And how can we ensure on a holistic level their kids have equal opportunity in schools? So that again differs, you know. So schools that are closer to flats, they tend to perform not as well.
Yes.
As schools that are in more affluent neighborhoods, and now access to private education, international schools. So the widening gap is quite significant in the urban areas. We have underestimated urban poverty because we have used a very minimalist approach to define poverty. Then if we say access to health care, access to good jobs, access to good schools that would lead you out of poverty cycle to a better housing area, then you are seeing sizable people, 40% of the city, living in different kind of facilities as opposed to other sections that are more affluent who can afford it. And that's why the disparities seem to be quite extensive when we measure it from that perspective. But if we take just poverty, 1,000 ringgit, then hardly, you know, because you're taking household income, husband, wife, husband works, wife works, they have overtime, then they're out of income poverty. But quality of life, they are low because opportunity for education, competitiveness nationally, more nationally, regionally in ASEAN and the world, whether they're getting the good jobs. So for unskilled, low-lying communities, they have to compete with migrant workers who are working under very, very restrictive living environment because they're here for short term. They come for 2 years, 4 years, 7 years, or 5 years. A migrant worker, he stays there. He's working more than 12 to 14 hours a day. He's eating in that spot. He's not with his family. They endure hardship. And then they will return back.
Mm-hmm.
But a Malaysian who lives and works here would find it difficult to compete at the low end. Now, for high end, he needs to be good in English. He has to move up the market. He must have the skills. So the disparities of income and possibilities will be there.
Coming up, we'll find out more about wealth distribution in Malaysia. Dr. Dennison, it almost feels like the affluent adopt this attitude of ignorance is bliss. We, as you said, we're living next to each other, but we don't really realize
yes.
what's really going on. And sure. when you spoke about schools and how, you know, children from flats or low income, you know, low cost flats go to these schools, I know of people who don't send their children to those schools because they're afraid of bad influence and things like that. So you're right. It's all about quality of life at the end of the
yes.
day. If you have a question for Dr. Dennison, do text 016-201-9000 or tweet to BFM Radio. We're talking about wealth distribution in Malaysia. We'll be back after this.
Business friendly Malaysia. BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasudhi. I know it sounds a little heavy on for a Friday afternoon, but it's really interesting. Dato Dr. Dennison Jayasuriya with me. He's a social policy researcher and activist from Institute of Ethnic Studies, University Kebangsaan Malaysia, and our topic is wealth distribution in Malaysia. Now, Dr. Dennison, what is the long-term effect of having a big gap between the have and have-nots?
I think, unfortunately, in countries where there are multi-ethnic population or diversity, it sometimes translates into hatred of one community as opposed to another. So that is something we need to watch out for, because very often in ethnicized political environment, consciously or unconsciously, people build on this theme. You know, watch out, that guy is taking all the money, he's getting all the business, we need to buck up, we need to fight them. And so that builds a deep-seated hatred. And sometimes one community looks at another community in that way. So it could be people wanting to access private sector and feel that there are cartels within the private sector that is controlling resources. Then if you look at the public sector, then people who cannot have access within the public sector then feel that there is another cartel controlling it. So then you have the big players like GLCs, or you've got big players like public listed companies. And due to political patronage or closeness, they then might get access to contracts, tenders, procurement, all these sort of things. And this then builds the feeling that they can't access it. I recently met a taxi driver on a journey back from a holiday with my wife. And often as I sit in a taxi, I always ask the driver, irrespective of their ethnicity, whether they own the taxi and the permit. And this gentleman looked Malay, and he was, you know, very polite to us in the early hours. And he said, no, this vehicle is not mine, the permit is not mine. And my immediate question to him was he an Indon driving the taxi? Mm-hmm. To which he vehemently opposed and he said, I'm from Perlis and I'm a Malay Bumiputra. My next question was, why is it that you can't get the permit yourself and the vehicle? And he said, I can't raise 5,000 ringgit. And then I said, why is it that you can't raise 5,000 ringgit? Isn't there Mara? Isn't there Tekun? He says, I don't know the people. You need to be connected. Which I was then shocked, because there are so many programs and mechanisms. And I met a young man who had no access, and he comes from a community. Now, how would this man react when he drives people and he comes to big houses, he goes to Damansara, he goes to Bangsa, he sees all these rich people living, and then he says, you know, I'm from a kampong, I'm marginalized, and somebody can politicize him and build some things. But his need is a basic, simple access to a loan. Federal government gives out taxi permits and money for people. And here is a man whom I met who can't. And so this is a key issue. And so access, irrespective of whether I know a politician, whether I know the system, whether it's women who are struggling from whichever community. And everybody has some sort of a complaint of some kind. And therefore, in order for people to access it, systems must be just and fair. They must be transparent. Information must be accessible. Then people will have a fighting chance. So it's like a Malaysian dream. If we say Malaysia boleh, then every Malaysian should have a good quality of life. A house, a job, good education, and Malaysia is rich enough to accommodate all our needs, but not our wants. But some people are getting too much. They are either having access to very big loans, which they are not accountable for, or they are getting big projects that they are not accountable for. So very simple. Would you give one taxi permit to one person, or would you give 100 taxi persons to one man to manage a company? Now, the man who takes 100 taxi permits and manages a company becomes rich overnight.
And he doesn't have to work very much.
He doesn't have to work. He just gets 100 people to get the permits. He gets it. You create a... But it's top down. Then somebody else has to work, 14 hours, 18 hours. And he's a fellow Malaysian. And so this is the issue of inequality and disparity. Because the system, very often it's institutionalized and structured. And that's why transparency, fighting against corruption, public open debate, greater media freedom is necessary to stop certain individuals from taking the good things of society just for themselves.
Where have we derailed, Dr. Dennison, since 1971?
I think we have achieved a lot through the new economic policy. While there are the difficulties and the challenges, I think all reporting of Malaysia's economic development and transformation has been quite positive, because we have been competitive, we have moved our communities, people have better quality of life. I think we cannot run away from that, because more people are in better situation. But inequality has widened, and that largely has come about because certain individuals connected to people in power have been able to access the resources more than others. Mm-hmm. And so if it is privatization projects, if it is big procurement, where is it going? What accountability mechanism? And so these are the things that we need to ensure, that distributive policies, you need to create wealth. It's within a system in which people need to have access. But to prevent corruption and abuse, then it has to be more transparent systems. There must be check and balance. So if the Attorney General, or largely the Auditor General's report, the debate of it, more public scrutiny or public spending, but also looking at private sector, because private sector and sections within that have been able to progress. But is it now in a responsible way? Are they paying equitable taxation? What is their social contribution back? We can see this much stronger in the GLCs, where their give back to society is stronger, because some are big players in the open market, as it were. And so that has to correspond back to fair wages. Salaries are central to ordinary people. You can't fleece ordinary people to make big bucks up there. But yet I understand the economy is such that capital moves to where labor is cheaper. Then we have to upgrade, and this is part of government's agenda. For upgrading, then quality of schooling, ability of people to have a good command in English, their IT skills, then you can become competitive, because you have to move away to service industry and other areas.
Do you think we have become a society that is afraid to be the whistleblower? I think we've seen enough cases where, at the end of the day, based on the Auditor General's report, whistleblowers have come out. And it seems like whistleblowers are being punished for that.
I think there has been a greater consciousness of anti-corruption practices. There's a greater outcry. I think there has to be stronger institutional reform for this. And the very fact that there have been exposure, media has articulated it, you have a strong opposition that's articulating it, you've got civil society. But I think there needs to be strong institutional check and balances. and that it is politically correct to keep things above board. We need to be open to public funding, to public spending, to ways that the economy is moving. We need to ensure. So we might slow down a bit, but it might be fairer distribution. People might be able to compete more, because if people trust a country that is secure in its business ethics and principles, mm-hmm. then investment comes. We need to strengthen unions, so the unions have become weaker over the period. Collective workers' opportunity to voice out their rights, but at the same time they must be responsible to ensure that economy doesn't suffer. These might sound as ideals, but these are necessary to be in place, because values are critical end of the day. Whether I'm honest, whether I'm trustworthy as a politician, as a businessman, as a corporate figure, would I keep all the riches for myself? Then I think if we are in an Asian environment in which religion is quite central, whether it's Islamic, Christian, Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, we begin to see there are certain parameters by which we operate. And that's one of responsibility, justice and fairness. And these must become the benchmarks of the economy. So we shouldn't tolerate injustice. We shouldn't tolerate underpay. And there are mechanisms now, better laws against abuse of maids and things like that, better protection so that they can get a day off, rest. So these kind of improvements need to take place. So public spending on housing, transport, schools, improving the quality so that we are competitive in the region and globally as a player, I think is central in this context.
Coming up, we also want to find out, in your opinion, whether wealth distribution systems that, you know, rely heavily on taxing those in the high income bracket, and what Dr. Dennison really believes in. We will find out just after this, and we are still taking questions via text message, text 0162019000 or tweet BFM Radio.
Brilliant financial model. BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon. It's The Bigger Picture, and it's Mira Sivasodhi. That's Dr. Dennison Jayasuriya, a social policy researcher and activist from the Institute of Ethnic Studies, UKM, with me. He's also the former Human Rights Commissioner with Suhakam. We are, you know, having this discussion with him on wealth distribution here in Malaysia. If you have a question, do text 0162019000 or tweet BFM Radio. Dr. Dennison, we have a text message from Chow from Kuala Lumpur, and he's asking, will the pending GST, government service tax, sort of widen the gap in the city?
I think one would have to look at indirect taxes in terms of service tax to what type of goods. I think taxation must be on higher on non-essential goods and types of services. And so I think some form of distinction needs to be made on indirect taxes. And that might assist. So let's say if you take mobile phones or other forms of things, then you know, what is the taxes link? So to type of food items and things of this sort. I think the key contribution has to be a focus on individual taxes. But here we have sizable number of Malaysians not paying tax at
all. Mm-hmm.
Because they are not in the taxable bracket, or they are self-employed. So that is something we need to really monitor, because a lot of people in business and more creative ways in getting people to pay their taxes, either by, you know, all kinds of policing of for taxation, to see their cars they drive, or the houses they have, or the shops they have, or how they don't disclose these. And I think there's a sizable section of Malaysian population that doesn't pay taxes. That's the second point. But the third more fundamental point, where money is coming for the government, is actually through petroleum and other forms of natural resources that are depleting. So petroleum funding and the way it's being used needs more public scrutiny. How much of that goes to the states, how much of that is being used for other purposes, needs greater scrutiny. So should citizens get 100 ringgit for books, should they get 500 ringgit as one-time gift from the government in terms of subsidy or petrol subsidies, would require greater discussion, because petroleum funding is a huge source of funding which is being used to subsidize government expenditure, size of the public expenditure at this point.
Which is not going to be available for the rest of our lives.
Yes, especially in terms of petroleum, because tin ore has passed. Timber would likewise be if it is not replanted. So there needs to be a greater public space discussion to see how these are being utilized in an effective way. And I think the checks and balances on this, while we do have parliamentary select committees and other forms, the size of the civil service, effectiveness of it, all these are open for discussion, and we need to scrutinize it a bit more in that sense. But I think it is still true in comparison to developed countries where individual taxation is sizably high. Then I think that is something worth reviewing and seeing this whole area for healthcare payments and other forms of ways in which, whether through insurance, private insurance, or other forms, we need to ensure, you know, the toll is a major issue. So should tolls be run in the privatized way? Who's making the money? Size of the money they are making? The companies are saying they are not making money, but invariably tolls is a huge amount of money that's going into private hands, and state has privatized a lot of essential services, water, electricity, and these sort of things, which it needs to review, because those monies are going to certain private companies, individuals, families, and groups. And that's why some disparities are also increasing as a result of access to these kinds of sizable, you know, what can call, you know, the, you know, cashing out of some of these. And I think it's worth examining. I might not have all the answers to the issues, but I think it's important to relook at a lot of the privatization projects, and while people might say you want industry to take over and run most of these, but nonetheless it has to be transparent, above board, and accountable, and reporting in such a way that these essential services that are to be provided will be in a way that you know, might be able to recover in the long term, but maybe not in the short term. You know? So certain sectors or areas might be neglected, and so the public sector investment in these as the biggest investment group then needs to look at it. So definitely taxation is something everybody wants, taxes down, but government services to increase. But I think the close correlation between this and increased salaries now would mean government needs to find more money to pay for all this. And it's actually people's money. So whether it's household, a housewife, you know, having 1,000 ringgit or 2,000 ringgit to spend is then translated into 200 million or billion for a federal government to spend. And how we manage this is quite critical. Where does money go for which parts? And so I think the whole budgeting and expenditure process needs to be brought back to accountability to ordinary people, so that people in the housing area will know whether their potholes are being filled, whether there's light, because they're paying different forms of taxes.
That's right.
And that it should link directly to them and services that are being provided. I think there is a gap between direct people's experiences in certain areas and how these are being utilized. And I think it needs. So popularization of Auditor General's report, public debates and discussions along that line, and even the budget process and expenditure process, development process. And I think this is where federal government in the past used to have consultative councils to look at 10-year plan, 5-year plan. We have shifted all from that to look at short-term gains. And that becomes a problem, because short-term gain, often the powerful, politically well-connected, big business tends to take it. But if you take longitudinal development planning, which Malaysia has a very good track record, then I think inequalities would be addressed in a more systematic, long-term fashion. So you can't fix many of these things with quick fix. You can give one 500 ringgit to a person, but unless you are willing to give much more, you can't take them permanently out of poverty other than building their capacities.
And of course, Dr. Dennison, recently the Human Resource Minister has approved the whole minimum wage issue. What is the link? Do you think a minimum wage will help pull a lot of these people out of the poverty line?
I would think essentially in any developed economy, a minimum wage is critical. But we are struggling with competitiveness within the region, Thailand, Philippines, Indonesia, because they're strong competitors in terms of workforce that they can provide, and labor factor becomes quite critical. But nonetheless, that's a cost that we have to take into account. Just for example, if you take Malaysian students here in Malaysia, don't work part-time, you know, because what they could earn might be very little. But every student who goes to Australia or England or even the US or other countries is working, because what they get per hour and things like that. This is part of a cost that needs to be built in, that we cannot continue to exploit workers because the unions are weak in one sense, that workers' rights and fair wages become part of a developed society. And part of seeing the rising cost, because we are not controlling, like Singapore, housing costs. It's unbelievable what it costs to buy a terrace house in KL. But I know the private sector wants high cost, and they keep low cost kind of housing. But if housing is something that is critical, then for the ordinary person renting a house, that's why in the city you got so many young people sleeping by the side of the road. Why? The housing is expensive, and people who are using public facilities like DBKL housing might not really be the poor. The means test has not been well done. So I think it's without doubt minimum wage, or even the wage for plantation workers that finally came. But it cannot be too low, you know, because if it's too low, it's not a protection. So what is the cost of business? What is the cost of running a restaurant? What is the cost of running a barber shop? How much should one pay in order that the worker is not exploited? And I think society needs to value labor more, because with that comes dignity. So people in better qualifications or with better options are getting a better deal in the country. So if you are an IT specialist, if you are in the banking line, if you are in the investment line, if you are in the professional sectors, you're making it. But if somebody comes to clean, do manual work or basic work, we are tending not to protect them well. But the whole city collapses if you don't have migrant workers today. So this is where I think we have to review many of these. I know industry will be upset with it, but if we want a developed society, then we have to review all this. Review workers in factories, production costs, and how we benchmark it. How to be far more efficient and effective in order that ordinary people's dignity is enhanced, how do we improve productivity of people through skills and other forms becomes very critical. So private sector also facilitates that and not just opts for cheap labor from other poorer countries, and then the movement of labor and other forms keep moving around, or unwilling to pay our good people. You know, a lot of Malaysians are working in Singapore at the top end and at the bottom of the employment pyramid, and they're moving, and that's not wrong in some sense, because they're moving to where you are valued better through the pay package. And so I think industry will have to relook at it. Federal government is looking at it in terms of employment opportunities within the civil service, and it's quite attractive now to be in government or in a university because of the different kinds of allowances and opportunities that are provided, and so that's the cost of a quality of life, and so we have to ensure in many ways that the disparity between the top 20 and the bottom 40 would not be too wide, because then you would see people going to the streets, people unhappy with the system, because too few people are controlling the wealth of the nation. I think in that sense, Malaysia has a broader base. The middle class has enlarged, even for the Bumiputra community, Indian community, Chinese community. But the data is showing the disparities are highest in the Malay community. And so they need to look at that seriously, because certain sectors of the Malay Bumiputra community is taking great advantage of affirmative action in a way that the bottom sections might be deprived. And that's why greater transparency in affirmative action, especially for the bottom 40%, needs to be far more systematically organized. And they should reduce affirmative action for higher levels, because they need to open in a competitive way. And you can't say that I'm a big business, give me the handicap that's needed, because they then should operate at that level. But for the bottom 40%, then it should go across the race, as has been indicated. So all communities, irrespective of race, religion, gender, location, especially Sabah, Sarawak, the Orang Asli community, their lives through education and quality of improvement should increase. So we've got sizable forest-based communities, interior communities in Sabah and Sarawak, and the disparity is disproportionate. Just take Kuala Lumpur to Slim River or Tanjung Malim or Kalumpang. Small town development has been ignored, because we have moved into new growth areas. We have left our abandoned smaller towns, and so everyone is flocking to the city. So it's part of development planning that needs to be revisited, and greater consensus in this. So how do we ensure there is good development in a small town like Kolokobu or Batangkali, or one of these places? Because all these towns were plantation towns before, and there was hype activity in those areas. So how do we ensure that in these small towns, with improved transport, people can actually come to the city, but they can have a good quality of life? Housing is cheaper. Schools should be improved in those areas. So it might be better and faster to live in a smaller town like Tanjung Malim and come to the city to work and go back, than to live in Subang or Damansara, because it might take you more than an hour to get back home from city center. So I think other cities have developed differently and address quality of life and affordability in the city. Malaysia needs to address this more seriously, and more public discussion is needed.
I'm just thinking how complacent I have been, Dr. Dennison, listening to you. But you know, if I want to play a larger role in this whole inequality of wealth distribution in Malaysia, what can I do? Sounds like a tall order.
No, I think I think one, consciousness, awareness, ensuring. Many of us have been strong advocates of people at the bottom 40%, and one of the best ways is to ensure that in the bottom 40%, where people are living in flats, the environment for learning is improved, that kids in these schools actually pick up. Those of us come from small towns, like I came from a small town like Banting in Kuala Langat. The schools were fantastic systems. We had no Form 6 in my school. We had to come to the city, KL or PJ. But the small town created people. So within the city, you have small towns where, you know, simple people in low-income families are living. But their opportunities are not as strong as I would say I had, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. Because the quality of primary and secondary school education was very competitive, and it was high, I would feel, of real high standard, even from a small town. And I think that needs to improve so that confidence building, capability, soft skills, because we are in a real globalized world, and the only way out, I would feel, out of poverty is through education and training. Malaysia has a lot of that at the high end, but we need to really improve it at small towns, in rural areas, and in poorer areas of the city. Because if not, these kids will never be able to compete with those kids, Malaysians, going to private school and international school, and all schools in affluent areas. And so this becomes quite critical. A tall order for government, but government has the public resources, but they need to ensure quality and more openness for discussion and more community participation in the schools, in industry, in that way.
Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts with us. Dr. Dennison Jayasuriya, a social policy researcher and activist from the Institute of Ethnic Studies, UKM. If you missed that interview, you'll be able to get it on podcast. Do log on to bfm.my/podcast. Or if you have an iPhone app, well, we're available on iPhone now. So get that app and download the podcast. This is The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.